Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
So it's an instinctive response, but if the fly's traveling too fast, it seems like, for a steelhead anyways, that it might be too much effort to chase it, type of thing. So I like to have a swinging fly, but controlling the speed enough so that it is accessible to the fish. That's kind of how I think in terms of it, you know, just kind of slowly getting away from them, controlling that speed by making sure you don't have too big of a downstream belly, you know, I think will go a long way towards, you know, interesting more fish.
That was Rick Kustich on the behavior of steelhead trout. Another chapter from another great steelhead angler today on the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the Fly Fishing Show. Find out what's new in the Facebook group by heading over to wetflyswing.com/Facebook. Before we get started, let's hear from our sponsors. Trestle designs, engineers, and manufactures industry-leading outdoor products and premium apparel. From their patented game-changing telescopic fly rod carrier and their specialized waterproof cases and fly boxes to their magnetic nipper system that are revolutionizing how people snip their line. Please head over to wetflyswing.com/trestle to get started today. That's wetflyswing.com/trestle, T-R-X-S-T-L-E, to support this podcast and an amazing product and brand today. Established in 1928, Deddy Flies is the oldest family-run fly shop in the world, now in their 94th year. Deddy's mission has always been to supply the fly fishing community with the finest products and services. Every fly they sell is either tied in-house or by a handful of select domestic tires. Please head over to wetflyswing.com/Deddy to grab your in-house flies today. That's wetflyswing.com/Deddy. D-E-T-T-E, to support this podcast and the oldest fly shop in the world. Rick Kustich is here to dig back into steelhead and the Great Lakes. We find out how he came to write his first book on the Great Lakes, how his advanced book came to be, and which word he'd remove from the title if he could change it today, and what new book he's working on as well. We're digging into all that and a bunch of tips and tricks along the way. Another passionate steelhead angler. Without further ado, here is Rick Kustich. How's it going, Rick?
Great, Dave. Great to be on. I listen to your podcast a lot, and I'm excited to be here.
Amazing. Yeah, this has been kind of a long time coming both ways. I think your name has come up a lot. We've had, we've had a bunch of, obviously, a lot of steelhead episodes and a lot of Great Lakes fishermen and trying to think of the last person we had on. I'll put a link into the show notes to that person, but we've had a ton of people. You're one of the people, probably one of the last people that I've really been wanting to get on, so I'm happy to have you here.
No, that's great.
So I wanted to start this off. I know you've been on a few different podcasts. I was listening a little bit of, I think, one from April, and you did a little summer. You know, and you've covered a little bit of your background, so I'm not going to go deep into that, but just give us a highlight of kind of, you know, how you got into, I know you had a fly shop at one point, but talk about how you first got into fly fishing and then take it to where you are today.
I started really just with fishing in general. And I know I have told the story a few times, but grew up on an island in the Upper Niagara River and literally surrounded by water. And pretty much every role model in my life was a fisherman, you know, from my grandfather, brother, cousin, uncle, my dad. And even my mom would take me fishing when other people weren't available. So really it was just in my blood from the beginning. My fly fishing kind of came along when I was about, 11 or 12 years old. Just started, you know, developing an interest beyond, I saw it in a few magazines, saw it in a, you know, television show here and there. And, knew that was an area that I wanted to, develop in, and, just basically was self-taught. About the only, going back in those days, this was the, early 70s, there was just, a few magazines and just a couple of books, and, ended up learning a lot through like the Joe Brooks trout fishing book. But self-taught as far as casting and really just anything that had to do with fly fishing. But I was just, I just remember having such an interest in it and just couldn't get enough. Caught my first fish when I was out of fly, when I was about 12. And again, all on my own at an old level. On an old level line, I was rigged up on a spinning rod. I was casting it off a spinning rod, and, it had self-tied some really crude damsel nymph imitation. And then it just kind of blossomed from there. Just insatiable desire to, kind of learn everything I could. And, luckily I was in the right place at the right time as the Great Lakes fishery really kind of blossomed as, at the same time when, my interest in, fly fishing was peaking, college after college. So there was a great intersection there in terms of the opportunity. And, I feel like I took, the best advantage of it I could.
Nice. I'm curious on a couple of things there on your family, as you looked at, sounds like everybody was into fishing. Did you see, was anybody into fishing from the, more of the industry side, actually as a way of work?
No, there really wasn't. It was more recreational, but I'll tell you, back in those days, it was still kind of on the cusp of more of a sustenance angle where, we fish for walleye, fish for bass, we caught bass back in those days, perch. And certainly none of it went to waste, and really was just, something that, we had regular fish fries and things of that nature. So it was more from that aspect, that it was part of, both recreation and, it was part of, our economy at that point.
Right, right. That makes sense. Yeah. So you're putting food on the table, right? This is not even though, you look at it sometimes now and you're like, well, what does it cost you to go out and go steelhead fishing, you add up the licenses and boats and stuff. You're like, well, we're not actually saving money. We could probably go buy some, but back then it was a big deal.
It was. Yeah, it really was. It was part of, like I said, it was part of, the meal planning and part of, the economy at that point. So, nobody was really involved from a professional standpoint, even though I do, when I was probably about 8 or 9, I started tying jigs and things like that for our local fishery and sold them to the local fishing club. So that was my first step into kind of the industry at that point. My brother did go on to, my brother's been in the fly fishing business for really, for the last, let me think, almost probably 40 years. So he did go on to work for Winston Rods out in Montana, and has been a full-time rod builder ever since. And began his own bamboo rod shop business about 15, 20 years ago.
Oh, wow.
So.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Yeah, I was just doing an episode. It's not out yet, but I guess it will be when this goes live. But it was like a classic fly fishing gear with Ward Tonsfeldt. And we were talking about bamboo, and it was interesting because I kind of thought, well, classic stuff would cost a lot more. But gosh, you can get a lot of classic gear, including bamboo rods, older rods, for a decent price, probably less than you can buy a new rod. I didn't realize your brother was doing the bamboo stuff. How is that looking for him? Is that pretty, pretty successful, pretty cool way to do it?
It was. So he was building bamboo for Winston for a number of years. And then him and Glenn Brackett broke off and began their business called Sweetgrass Rods.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, certainly was, it probably peaked a few years ago, but they're continuing to, push forward with, a fair amount of, demand for their product. So probably as much as they can handle anyways.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. Yeah, I didn't realize Sweet Glass was Grass was your brother's. That's cool. Yeah, mm-hmm. I haven't talked to Jerry yet, but maybe we'll work on getting him on as well. I it's obviously tough to connect with everybody, but well, let's dig into a little bit here. I mean, there's a few things. We're going to take some tangents along the way, but I was hoping to talk a little bit about, you've got the book, Advanced, The Great Lakes Fly. What's the exact title on that book?
Advanced Fly Fishing for Great Lakes Steelhead.
Yeah, exactly. And I know I've heard you, that there's been some, questions on that where people, the Advanced, right? Maybe you would change the name and take out the Advanced because people think, tell us the story of that, first of all. Like, is the book for advanced anglers or is it just a kind of a general book? What would you say to that?
You know, I that's probably the one thing that I would have changed is the title. And the one I think area when I read any reviews, probably about the only negative reviews I ever see on it is just some confusion over the title as to, who it should apply to. But I guess what I had in mind with Advance is back in 1999, my brother and I, Jerry, and I released a book titled Fly Fishing for Great Lakes Steelhead. That we co-authored, and I kind of saw this book as a step past that. It has a lot more emphasis on swinging the fly, much more emphasis on the spey fishing and the setup for spey fishing and spey casting. So I guess I saw that as where in my mind saw that as the advancement. It's continuing to the fishery, at least in my mind anyway, started out where hardly anybody was fly fishing. And, even some of the, some of the gear anglers back in those days would say, well, you can't catch these things on a fly. And then, once you prove that, you can't catch them on a fly that's moving. It has to be dead drifted. And then, you can't catch them on big flies and things of that nature. So, each step of that has been, for me, disproven. It's been part of, my own journey. And, so I kind of saw that, the swing and the fly, the spey fishing part of approaching the Great Lakes fishery is kind of, the final advancement as far as I'm concerned. So I guess that's kind of where the title comes from, even though it, creates some confusion.
No, that makes total sense. I think I see that for sure. The spey was, at one point it wasn't there and now it's fully there and thriving. I'm curious, because we had another listener recently reach out and he said, he wanted to hear, I think he said something like, bring on a comparison, Great Lakes Steelhead guests versus the West Coast. It's kind of this talk about the differences or flies or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you get those questions about the difference between the two, like for somebody who, say, hasn't either fished the West, I know you fish both, if you haven't fished the West Coast and Great Lakes, what would you tell them? Are there a lot of differences these days? I mean, I know there's differences in sizes of rivers, but what would you tell them just generally on that?
I think generally the fish react similarly, but it has a lot to do with the conditions and the environment that impacts the fish's behavior. And I think, understanding that is really key. But, under similar situations and similar conditions, whether you're on the West Coast or in the Great Lakes, I find that fish react to a fly in a very similar manner. The grabs, the takes, many of the, the fly patterns I use in the Great Lakes are the same as they are out West. I'm using, on larger rivers in the Great Lakes, using the same equipment, same tips. But I think just the key is just understanding. I would say a standpoint that, the smaller rivers in the Great Lakes, especially some of the spate rivers, their conditions change a little more rapidly, and you can see dramatic temperature differences, from a day-to-day basis. And, and really paying attention to, to some of those, those condition changes are what I think, maybe impacts some perceived different behaviors between, the West Coast and Great Lakes fish. But, in my mind, they're very similar, and how I approach them is similarly, just really kind of keeping an eye on, how the conditions impact the fish's behavior.
Nice. I was just thinking, going back on the book again, you mentioned 99. Was that your first book that you wrote in the fly fishing space?
Actually, that was the third book. I started with a book that was called Fly Fishing the Great Lakes Tributaries, which was a self-published book in the early 90s. I think it was released in 92. That was really one of the first, probably the first book on the Great Lakes fishery. Although I look back on it now and it's pretty crude, and you know, I really even my philosophies have changed dramatically since then. But it was, you know, since it was really one of the first books on the market on it, it was a, right. It was a good seller for us, and you know, and everything.
Were you swinging back then? Were you swinging in 92?
Just starting to, yeah. By the late 80s and early 90s, I was definitely swinging flies, particularly on some of the bigger water. And it does, you know, that book does address that a little bit.
I was curious on the, just swinging again, we've talked, you know, we've had a few episodes on the history, but I'm just trying to connect that, you know, kind of what your history. And so when did, so 92, you had that, when did you start? I mean, how did you get into the swinging? Where did that start out?
You know, I think influenced a little bit by, you know, some of the, just really some of the West Coast literature that I was able to find back in those days, you know, probably, just starting to even think, you know, Trey Combs's first book, you know, Lonnie Waller's videos, things of that nature, you know, certainly had a, you know, positive impact on, you know, knowing that that would work, you know, certainly, in the Great Lakes. So I think those things had some influence on it. And then, you know, you just kind of, as with all techniques, you kind of just test them out a little bit and you keep pushing it and keep pushing it. And it was almost immediate for me once I started catching fish, swinging flies, that I would much rather do that than catching them any other way. Even though I knew that, it became obvious that maybe it wasn't, from a number standpoint, wasn't going to be the same. But from an overall experience, and I think that's always what has driven me from a fly fishing standpoint, is a little bit more. I love having success, and but I do feel like the one thing that has kept me engaged in fly fishing over all these years is, continuing to try to raise the bar a little bit and, know that, quality over quantity is, for at least me, is the way to continue to do that. And, so I think that was a driving force behind swinging flies for me, even back then.
What do you think? I'm curious on the, you know, if you look at, and this is kind of maybe a hard question, but percentages wise, you know, if you had, you're out there right now on the Great Lakes swinging flies with what we're going to talk about today versus nymphing. I mean, if you were to do one a full day and the other, you know, how many more fish would you catch nymphing, do you think?
Again, I think it really is driven on conditions. I think when you have good water temperatures and you have, you know, good flows and maybe water with a, you know, a little bit of a stain to it, you know, when it's perfect for swinging, you know, I think there's days where, you know, you almost can go head to head with nymphing.
There you go.
Yeah. But I think where that breaks down, particularly on smaller Great Lakes, rivers and streams, or when the water gets low and clear, the fish are hunkering down, you know, in the structure, along ledges, behind rocks and, you know, behind boulders and things like that. That's where the nymphing really excels, under those conditions. And you really, from a swing standpoint, you know, in terms of numbers, you know, it's no way that it's going to compete with, with the dead drift under certain conditions like that. But, you know, once again, I try to adapt my swing approach to meet those conditions, you know, whether it's going with smaller flies or, you know, more of a stealthy, you know, setup, right? You know, and things of that nature to try to meet those conditions.
So in the advanced book, you talk a little bit about everything, right? I mean, do you touch on the nymphing as well in that book?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. Cause I do think that's as much as that, you know, the swinging is the way that I prefer to catch fish. It certainly has to acknowledge that there's, you know, a place and time for other techniques as well. And, you know, in terms of, you know, as people progress into the sport, even to catch your first steelhead or, you know, your first year or two of steelheading, you know, dead drifting patterns is a really good way to get oriented or initiated into steelheading. And especially if you're a trout fisherman and you know you're used to dead drifting and things like that, and you're making that transition to steelhead, you know, it's no better way to do it probably than that. And then, you know, hopefully within a few years, you will, if you stick with it and you know, continue to have a desire to fish for steelhead, that eventually you'll look for something more. And, you know, that's something more for a lot of people is swinging flies.
That's right. Nice. Well, let's, I wanted to kind of touch on just try to dig into a few things here. If maybe we could focus on some advance or some different tactics, but just walk through a few of the things in that book that we're talking about here. And I'll put a link in the show notes to that. But, you know, I guess we could just start, you know, equipment obviously is something that, you know, we talk a lot about and things like that. But I think it's always interesting, especially with the fly and the swinging, because there's a lot of different lines and there's confusion out there. There can be confusion. If you look at, I think chapter one, you talk about the equipment and the rig. What's that look like for you as far as just give us, and I guess we could be talking Great Lakes. Let's just stay on the Great Lakes. Typically, if you're fishing, does it vary a lot between the larger, the small rivers, whether you're using how long of a rod you're using, the lines and things like that? Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I think it does. I find that my rod selection seems to be getting shorter and shorter each year. I just enjoy, and I do try to match the rod to the size of the water, but you know, I'm finding going shorter and shorter, 12, 11 feet, even especially with some of the shorter heads right now, it just seems to connect me more to the river, connect me more to a fish when I have a fish hooked up. And, you know, with the shorter heads, it just kind of makes everything more versatile, allows me to fish, you know, smaller waters, tighter areas, things of that nature. So, you know, when I can get away with it, I really am using rods of, you know, 12 to 11 feet for the most part. But where I tend to go longer is on the bigger water. And it isn't necessarily for the length of the cast, because I feel like I can make, you know, good lengthy casts with 12 to 11 footers. But a lot of it has to do with how deep I'm wading. You know, I know when I'm fishing a handful of the bigger rivers that I fish, if I know I'm going to be wading deep, yeah, you struggle a little bit with the shorter rods, you know, if you're doing that all day long. So yeah, you gain a little more leverage with, you know, 13, 13 and a half, even 14 footer, that you lose with the shorter rods. And, you know, over the course of a day, I just kind of like having that extra length when I know I'm going to be wading deep or making real long, you know, where it's required to make really long casts. So I try to keep all the rods in my arsenal, but certainly use more shorter rods these days, especially on you know, the Great Lakes waters.
Perfect. What about a line? What does your line setup look like? Are you using the same sort of line most of the time?
Yeah, it really varies again based on the different types of water. You know, I rely a lot on Skagit heads though, for, you know, just more as an efficient delivery system. You know, when I first started, I kind of had a love-hate with Skagit heads. I mean, I understood their, you know, their versatility and their effectiveness for delivering tips and heavier flies. But a lot of the lines that were on the market just seemed so cumbersome to cast. You know, they were clunky. But I think, you know, most of the line manufacturers now are kind of catching up to that and at least producing Skagit heads that have some feel to them now. And, you know, I think that's helped. So I, you know, I think with that, I end up using more Skagit heads than I probably have in the past. But when I'm fishing up in the water column, you know, lighter flies, or I'm trying to go stealthy, you know, I certainly break out a Scandi or a, you know, Scandi kind of compact Scandis, as well. So I like the feel of those types of lines too. I prefer to try to find some balance between enjoying my casting and making sure that I can have fishing effectiveness. So, you know, and then on bigger waters, I mean, a couple of the bigger rivers that I fish, you know, I do go, I still use some mid belly lines, some 45 to 55 foot lines, you know, especially when I can fish up in the water column a bit. So again, just trying to match, you know, match the mm-hmm. tackle to the situation. But a large degree of Skagit lines, particularly when fishing down the water column.
Gotcha. I'm just curious. And is it the Cattaraugus River? Is that one near you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's certainly one of our main rivers that I fish. Mm-hmm.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah. We had a recent guest on, that was talking about, he's up in that part of the woods too.
Mm-hmm.
We did a couple episodes on like the Arc Flick Trout Unlimited, chapter, mm-hmm. and connecting with Michael there and stuff like that. But, he mentioned that river and how, mm-hmm. and we talked a little bit about, but we didn't have it. We didn't go into all the tips and tricks and stuff, but mm-hmm. I'm curious, maybe we can think of that river. Like if you were going mm-hmm. there during the peak of the season, or when is the peak? Let's just start there. When is the peak of the season on that river?
Well, it starts in this year. It was a good example of that when we get some decent water flow, by the middle to end of September, there's usually fishable numbers there. And October through November, I would say is, prime time. Mm-hmm. In New York, we mainly have, winter run fish. So they start, their run in the preceding fall. So October, November, the characteristic of that river, though, that kind of defines it, is it's very fickle in terms of water conditions. Runs through, and a lot of it's just natural, but in the river itself and then a number of its tributaries run through areas that are just laden with clay banks, and just gets in it, and it drains a huge area. So when you get a rain, it has a tendency to rise, but also, dirty with the sediment that's created by the clay. And it can take a few days to clear off. So, unfortunately this year we've had a lot of rain, and we just, once we got past, early October, it's been hard to find consistency in terms of days on the river. So that's the one downside of it. On a few years it'll fish into December. And then it tends to be a pretty good spring river as well, starting in April. And, once we have all the snow melt and April even into May, it can fish for, both fresh fish and fish dropping back down to the lake. But, yeah, it's a beautiful place. And it's a great river for swinging. But its fickle nature is really probably the most apparent characteristic of it.
Gotcha. Okay. So if we look at that river and you're fishing, so I guess by the time this publishes the first part of that run will be over, but, what would you be using there? What would the rod be? Would you be using that really short rod on that river?
Yeah, I generally use, the 11 footer. I would rig with that and about a, 450, skagit if I'm fishing down deep, and, usually a tip, for the most part, on that, I would run about a 10-foot poly leader, usually one that's in the 6 to 7 inch per second sink range. An unweighted fly when I can, when I'm fishing nice, even flows. If I'm fishing water that has a little more surface tension, or where I feel like I need to get it down into a slot along a bank or something along that line, I also have a fly that has a little weight on it as well, just to kind of cut through and get it down quick.
What are you on those flies? What are you using to add a little bit of weight?
Generally, I fish a lot of tube flies, so I'll just add a cone to the front of the tube. A lot of times what I'll do is I'll just add the cone while I'm on the river, and then just use a lighter to flare up the plastic to keep it in place.
Yeah, the cones, it seems like that's a pretty popular way to do it. Do you find that's still not the most popular? Why do you think the cones aren't, it seems like just the perfect way because you can, a lot of adjustment and flexibility. What's your take on those? Is it the most popular thing now out there?
I think it's a very, sensible, versatile way to approach it. I'd say more anglers are tying on shanks though, even in the Great Lakes, than they are on tubes. I like the simplicity of a tube. But I do feel as though, even just tying on a shank, and my fishing partner, Nick Pianessa, full-time tyer, he and I agree with this. I mean, he tends to like the shanks just because it adds just that little bit of extra weight, a little less surface tension. That's the one downside of the tubes is, they add that surface area there and they don't sink quite as quickly. So even an unweighted shank is going to get you deeper than a, unweighted tube. So there is an advantage to that. And I do see where a lot of guys, tie on shanks. So, just to me, the tubes are just one step simpler, you know, especially when I'm trying to tie a lot of flies. And I've had good success on them too. So, you know, I've had good success on tubes.
And now let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. With more than 40 years of experience in coffee, the Angler's Coffee Team roasts a full range of coffees with one goal in mind, delivering excellent coffee to every single angler. Responsibly sourced from farms using sustainable growing practices, you can rest easy knowing you are doing your part. Roasted and shipped within 48 hours to assure freshness. For me, it's all about that freshness and taste. When I crack open a bag of Anglers in the morning, I feel good because I know it not only tastes amazing, but I'm supporting great movements along the way. With a coffee blend for every taste, a dry dropper on-the-go tea bag option, and a roast sampler, you know Joe at Anglers is serving your needs. It's time to step up to better coffee and more impact for the fish species and causes that we love. Just visit wetflyswing.com/anglers to grab your bag of greatness today. That's wetflyswing.com/anglers, A-N-G-L-E-R-S, to make a change and get a sweet taste today. Okay, now back to the show.
What about, I know, let's see, I guess this is, I think, chapter 2 of your advanced book. Talks about like casting, you know, obviously that's another huge struggle for a lot of people because it's the casting can be like a lifelong journey. Maybe start there just for the curious on you. How long did it take you to get the spay cast dialed in? And do you feel like that's still the biggest struggle for most steelheaders transitioning?
Yeah. I mean, you know, in terms of from my own casting, I mean, I think it's a continuous. You know, I feel my feeling on casting is it's something you can learn in a few hours and spend the rest of your life trying to master. You know, and I still feel like I'm in that, you know, it's somewhere in that process. You know, I'm always, you know, trying to get better and trying to learn some new things. And, you know, I think even from the standpoint that, you know, it's like any, you know, finely tuned sport. If you're not doing it all the time, your timing gets off. So, I mean, even I notice a difference if I, you know, I haven't cast in a week or two, you know, it takes me a little time to get my timing back. So, you know, I think it's just something that you just have to, you know, kind of keep at and practice and get good technique. But yeah, I think casting has become a bit easier with the shorter head lines. I mean, I think, you know, schedule lines have made, you know, shortened the learning curve a bit. So, you know, I do think that it has provided the opportunity for more anglers to become proficient in a shorter period of time. So I do think, though, that it is still somewhat of a deterrent to at least people making that step from, you know, single-handed use to two-hand use. But I do feel as though, you know, I think it is more inviting than it probably ever has been in the past in terms of being able to do that. It, you know, I think the one thing that possibly turns people off, I shouldn't even turn them off, but confuses people even more is just the rigging. You know, and I've even seen it this year with, you know, guiding and, you know, a class that we had earlier. It's just, you know, the, you know, skagits and scandies and, you know, loops and tips and leaders. And, you know, that seems to be more of a point where people struggle than even the casting itself. And I, you know, I just feel as though that part of it, that confusion, you know, maybe keeps people away from, you know, getting into the two-handed space, even more than the casting.
Yeah, we make it more confusing probably than it has to be because I think it's, yeah, I think back to the episode quite a while back Marty Shepard had on, he talked about, you know, just getting into it. We were talking about like West Coast steelhead, but yeah, I mean, it's pretty much just go grab a skagit line, like you said, go grab a skagit line, grab a couple tips and, you know, get out there and do it. I mean, but it's more specialized, like you said, depending on water conditions, things like that. But really, you know, to be honest with you, it's always been, you look at single head. I mean, back before the spay thing was the game, you know, it was still, you were still chopping up sinking lines on your single handed mm-hmm. rod and still, you know what I mean? It was still just as confusing probably back then. what's going to get the newbie, like the new person to this, you know, how's it going to be easier for them to get into it? Or is it pretty easy right, you know, right now?
You know, I think just continued education. I mean, and there is good education out there. I mean, you know, there are some really good shops that, you know, can guide individuals. They're, you know, some of the spay claves that are around help individuals. I mean, there's a lot of good YouTube videos and things of that nature. So I do think, you know, that the key is just, you know, finding one of those resources that has, you know, the ability to kind of really sort it out for you. I actually am working on a book right now that is hopefully going to help that process out quite a bit. But I can tell you, even when I'm writing, it's interesting to try to put things into the right buckets to kind of help, you know, explain the process on a simple basis. I mean, to me, it is fairly simple, but like I said, you know, some of the experiences I've had this fall really indicates that, you know, it has to be explained in a manner that makes people feel comfortable and, you know, feel like they're progressing.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of their knowledge level and understanding of it, you know, in as, you know, clear terms as possible.
Right. How would you explain that? Just, I mean, it sounds like you're right in the middle of working on it with the new book. So if you had somebody that was, you know, who had never picked up a spay rod before, and you were going to be coaching them, what would you tell them?
You know, I think, you know, first trying to identify, you know, what you want to do with it is the key thing. You know, what kind of water you're going to be fishing for, what your quarry. So, I mean, I think that's really always going to be a starting point. You know, just even in terms of, like we talked about, you know, the rod length and size and things of that nature. So just picking out the tackle. But, I tend to agree, even what you were saying with Marty before. I mean, you know, just trying to keep it simple and not get too complicated. You know, get yourself a, you know, first of all, kind of understanding the importance of lining up a head with the rod that you choose. I think that's, you know, even just the most important starting point, because, you know, I've seen it, you know, over the years. We talked about, you know, rigging for, you know, you mentioned it with single hand rods. You know, a rod can feel so different with the wrong line versus the right line. And, you know, I think that even gets exaggerated even more with a two-handed rod. You know, you want to make sure that it's, you know, that it's rigged properly, even though a lot of rods today can handle a pretty wide range of grain weights. You know, just finding the right head and, you know, the right line for that rod, I think, is an important starting point too. Because I, you know, too often I have seen where, and whether it be guiding or at a spay clave, where someone's trying to make a cast, but they're casting with a rod that's just, you know, totally imbalanced in terms of the line that's on there. And so I think, yeah, you know, I think getting just that starting point, you know, of understanding what you're fishing for and then getting a line. And it can just be as simple as just starting with the skagit, because that's going to be the easiest to cast with at the beginning. But making sure that skagit is the right, you know, the right size, both in terms of length and but a grain weight for that rod.
That's right. And maybe the better thing to do, or one of the things to do, is, yeah, like just like we all, you know, always say, going to your local fly shop, and if you can get a lesson and get hooked up, that'll probably save you, you know, a year or so of probably wasted time, right, learning for your, I mean, you learned, a lot of us learn by ourselves, but do you recommend, do you have a local fly shop near your area now?
So, we don't, you know, and you had mentioned it earlier, that the only real shop that, is in town here is Orvis store. So there is a local shop, but it's not a locally owned shop. It's an Orvis corporate store. We owned a shop for a number of years. I think it went as long as 20 years, but I did sell that, and then it did close down about, 3 or 4 years ago, unfortunately. So, but there are a few other good shops in, you know, in the Great Lakes area that do cater to, you know, do cater and, you know, promote swing fishing and two-handed fishing. So, you know, lining up with a couple of those is probably the best way to go. And there's, you know, good instructors pretty much in every state, you know, across the Great Lakes now, good guides, instructors. But I agree 100%, you know, spending a day or two with a knowledgeable individual is probably going to be one of the best ways to really shortcut your learning curve.
Do you, you know, that shop, what was the name of the old shop, the shop you had that you owned?
Oak Orchard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Started it up on the Oak Orchard Creek, back in the early to mid nineties, and brought it into the Buffalo area, maybe 3-4 years after that. And that's where it existed for, you know, the time until it closed.
Gotcha. Do you miss the, having the fly shop, all that, looking back on it?
There's things I miss about it. There's definitely things I regret that, you know, I certainly would like to still be in that business. It was just kind of a life thing at that time. You know, some changes in my life, a divorce and, just some things were changing rapidly that it just seemed like the right time to make a move. But you know, there's a lot of times where I think back of that, I wish I wouldn't have been so hasty and, kind of kept at it. So I would, you know, it'd be something that I wish I had now, to be honest with you, but a little too late in my life to restart anything. So.
Yeah. It's interesting. It seems like, yeah, the fly shop thing, you know, there's obviously lots of great fly shops and it's not easy. And I know myself, you mm-hmm. know, my dad had a little shop back in the day. And, you know, I remember mm-hmm. it was kind of one of those things where I remember my mom or somebody, they were talking about back when I was a little kid, and they're talking about this old guy who used to have the old fly shop when my dad was young, and talking about how rough of a life. Not rough life, but it was more like, you know, it wasn't like he wasn't making billions on the fly shop or whatever. And it was a struggle. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking like, wow, okay, that is a struggle. I wonder what it would be like for my dad. And, you know, to be honest with you, it was a struggle, right? It was a struggle at times. And, so I don't know. I think it depends on who you are. I think like all this stuff, man, if you love it, if you're passionate about it, you can make anything work.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a struggle in ways back then, and in the early or late 90s, early 2000s, you know, there was a fair amount of competition with small shops, but there was also, didn't seem like there was the big box influence at that time. And, you know, it was, I thought, a good time to own a shop. And, you know, we had some very good years and, I had a lot of trials and tribulations. It was just a lifestyle. It was a good time back at that time too. I had a lot of good friends that were associated with the shop, a lot of good people that, that either worked for us or with us and things like that. So it just was a great, great community of people that supported it. And I really miss that part of it too. You know, I miss, I still have a lot of those relationships and a lot of those friends, but it's different than it was back then. And, I really cherish that. And, when I look back at it, it was a great time.
Yeah. It's a good, get that perspective on it. I was curious, you mentioned the Spayclave. Is there a Spayclave up in your neck of woods?
There is one on the Salmon River, which is about 2.5 hours east of where, I am in Western New York, near the Buffalo area. It's called Spay Nation, and I'm not sure where it stands now. I mean, COVID kind of, there was going to be one year where they were going to take a year off, and I think that was going to start again. And then I think COVID got in the way. So I'm not sure what it typically occurs in June. I'm not sure what the plan is for the future with that. I do think though, it's going to be back in place at some point in the future. I'm just not sure, what the plans are there. But it's been a really good, successful spay gathering for sure.
Yeah, nice. Well, on that note, and going back to just thinking of your book again. So casting, that is a struggle. What would be a tip would you have? I'm not sure. We're kind of on this line of trying to think of advanced tips, but what comes to mind when you hear the casting struggle, right? What do you tell somebody, if they're having a hard time getting the fly out there?
Yeah, I think, to me, the spay cast is a series of steps, and each step has to be completed in order to complete an entire cast. So that's kind of how I learned about the cast. It's kind of how I still think about it. It's kind of how I try to teach it still. But being able to make the forward or switch cast, just where you're not changing directions, just keeping it all in one plane, you know, is the essential building block of every spay cast. So to me, getting to that point is really needs to be the first step in terms of getting your timing down, being able to, you know, understand an anchor point, understand a D loop, and being able to complete cast every time. So to me, you know, that's the starting point. And you know, you can do that. You don't have to do that on moving water. You can do that on a pond, or you know, anywhere that where there's some water to create some tension. But just making that forward cast and just being able to, you know, always stick your anchor point, being able to get some nice energy in the D loop, and and get your bottom hand, you know, engaged. I think if somebody is going from single hand casting to two hand casting, the biggest hurdle is to understand that it's truly two hand casting, and that you know, your upper hand, and you know, generally it's going to be the dominant hand for somebody that's moving to two handed casting, is now more of a guide as it is the power. And your power really needs to come from the bottom hand, and really understanding, you know, to have a heavy bottom hand, pulling that bottom hand in to really get that fulcrum, I think is one of the, you know, the key steps. So really just, you know, practicing that and getting the timing and the form down in that forward spay, and really understanding the, you know, that using that bottom hand, I think is a step that everybody needs to go through if they're going to be effective casting, you know, being able to make all the casts.
How do you know when you're using that bottom hand correctly, or is it just you can see it in your cast?
Yeah, I think both. I mean, the best, I guess, tool to, or the best gauge of that is where that hand's ending up when your forward stroke is complete. You know, it really should be pulling right into your body. So, you know, it should be out when your D loop is formed, you know, pushed out away from the body, and then it should be, you know, it's kind of smacking up into the body when you're completing your forward stroke. You know, or you know, especially, you know, and then sometimes your hands will be positioned a little bit higher so that, you know, it'll be coming more into your arm. But either way, it should be coming into your body at some point at the end of the stroke. So I think that's really the gauge. And you should just feel that, you know, you should feel that there's more pull than there is push.
Yeah, exactly. Do you, so in your books or in this, the advanced book or this new book you're working on, how do you explain the casting in the book? Is it like a step-by-step photos, or how do you do that?
Yeah, definitely step-by-step, you know, with the photos in there. You know, I think that, in my mind, it does a good job explaining the casts. I think the casts are complicated enough and everybody kind of learns on their, at their own way. So I do think that, you know, pictures help some people. I do think, you know, videos help other people. You know, hands-on instruction is better for other people. So, you know, I think the book does a good job at explaining the casting on a, you know, from using pictures and text. But I'm not sure that's always the best learning tool for every individual.
Yeah. I was just trying to think of a couple of resources. Episode 233, we had Ed Jaworowski on, and he's got the book on perfecting the cast. And I think, yeah, I mean, he talks about it, how, yeah, it's all, you know, together. I'll put a link to that, because I don't want to butcher the description, but that was a good episode that talked a little more just about casting in general. So, okay, cool. Well, we're kind of working through. I'm just kind of thinking of a good, you know, way to work through. And we're looking, kind of thinking about your advanced book. Is the new book you're working on now, tell us again, is there a title, and what, how is this different from the current advanced book, or your old advanced book?
Yeah, so really, it doesn't have an exact title yet. We're still, I'm about 90% through the writing portion of it, but it is going to focus on just spay in general and kind of the state of modern spay fishing, and have a heavy emphasis on both rigging, equipment, casting, but yeah, certainly a more of an emphasis on the fishing part of it as well. And really all aspects of two-handed casting and, you know, where it can be applied, even kind of blurring the line of, of really what spey fishing is, you know, traditionally been anyways.
Nice. Yeah. So you're, this is a good evolution. I mean, you, so like you said, back in 92, you've got the first book, which is just kind of Great Lakes. And then you write the advanced book, which is kind of everything advanced. And now you're taking it the next step further, going into just spey. What's going to be the next book after that? So after you get the spey book,
I don't know. I think I'm going to take a break after this one. You know, the books start out, I always, you know, I have some great enthusiasm for them at the beginning, and, you know, and then in the middle part, things just really start cranking out. You know, I give my outline, and, you know, the ideas kind of just keep flowing. And, you know, there's a lot of times where I can't write them down as fast as they're coming into my head. And it just seems like you get to the last 10% of the book, and it's just such a grind. And that's where I'm in right now. So thinking about another book at this point is tough. But, you know, give me another 2 or 3 years, and then, you know, I'll probably be ready for another one at some point. I would like to do a trout book at some point. I mean, you know, I have spent a lot of time just fishing for trout in different ways, you know, and whether it's, I really love dry fly fishing, I like streamer fishing and things of that nature. And it's really been, you know, the one consistency in my fly fishing over the years is, you know, I always spend a certain amount of fishing days fishing for trout, and it's where I started, and it's where my roots are. So I would like to do some kind of treatment on that at some point.
There you go. And you also have a musky book, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's my most recent book. That was, let's see, that was 2017, I believe that was released. So I kind of had a fairly lifelong connection and passion to muskie. You know, growing up on the Niagara River, there's been a muskie population there, you know, ever since I was a kid. And, you know, kind of somewhere in the late 80s, early 90s, my interest in, you know, the fishing, the river, and muskie fishing kind of connected with my interest in fly fishing. So been fly fishing for muskie ever since, you know, the early 90s. That's been quite a journey. It's back in those days, there was nobody doing it, to a point now where it has become fairly popular, and, you know, which is great. There's really some solid populations of muskies now, you know, fishable populations of muskies in, you know, numerous states and provinces, and, you know, a lot of fly anglers now with the equipment that's available today are really taking advantage of it.
Yeah, it's, I mean, there's a lot of people probably listening right now that are interested, obviously, in steelhead, but, you know, what would you tell them if they, you know, hadn't fished for muskie yet? Is it, you know, I mean, it's similar in some ways, right, to steelhead, but is it, what would be the pitch that say somebody would want to go for muskie? Because it's kind of challenging, right?
It is. It is a challenge. You know, the muskie has earned its reputation as the cast of 10,000 or the fish of 10,000 casts for a reason. Sometimes it.
So the fish of 10,000 and the steelhead is a fish of 1,000 casts, right?
Yeah. So you're adding another 9,000 casts. Right. That's probably about right. That's what it seems like too, to be honest with you. At times, they can be, they're, you know, muskies are, they're top of the food chain predator anywhere they exist. And, you know, and they act that way. They act with a certain swagger, and, they're intelligent fish, and they're difficult to fool at times. And you know, they usually are quite careful about what they eat, and, you know, finding a fish that's in the right mode, and, you know, presenting your fly in a way that triggers it to take is the challenge in that sport. And, I would say it is, you know, trying to get some, it's in a very exciting experience. It's one that, yeah, there are some similarities between muskie and steelhead in the, you know, I'd say in the covering the water and the persistence that it takes, you know, that, you know, it could happen on any cast, but it probably isn't going to happen on any particular cast. And really just kind of understanding the quarry, understanding water, you know, why a fish is in a particular place versus where it's, you know, where you wouldn't expect them. You know, that's all part of it. And certainly understanding that you're going to be making a lot of casts, you're going to be out there, but I'll tell you, when you hook one of these fish, especially a bigger one, even to this day, after fishing for them for 30 years, I mean, your knees are knocking, and it is probably you know, some of the most exciting experience you'll have in fly fishing. And, you know, and it's not just about the catching. It's really about the whole approach. But when you do hook one, and it's interesting because, you know, even a fight with a big muskie doesn't generally last real long. I mean, people will see a picture of a big muskie that you caught and say, geez, that must have taken you, you know, half hour to reel that fish in. And, you know, and the reality of it is you landed it in 2 or 3 minutes by putting, you know, the right amount of pressure on them and everything. But I'll always say with how much effort it takes to hook that fish in the first place, that's the most exciting 2 or 3 minutes of all of fly fishing as far as I'm concerned. When you get one on and, you know, your buddy's there with the net and you know, and you want to enjoy the flight, you want to enjoy the experience, but you also want to, you know, complete that task and get that fish in the net. It's just, you know, when you finally do, you know, especially when it's a big fish, I mean, it's this moment of elation, but it's just also this moment of relief that, you know, you're able to kind of pull it all off and put it together. But it is just really is the most exciting experience, you know, in fly fishing, as far as I'm concerned. So that would be the selling point.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good selling point. How does it compare to, you know, like just the take, you know, you got the steelhead take, that whole process up to the take versus the musky process up to the take?
In terms of the actual take of the fish?
Yeah, like if you're swinging flies for steelhead versus the musky, yeah, I know you're sometimes are chasing it all the way in. So is it better than a steelhead take?
I think a lot of times it's different. Although there can be some similarities. I mean, that heavy grab of a steelhead is really that second when you realize there's a steelhead coming tight to your swinging fly is, yeah, that is an instant that really is, you know, that excitement that I think characterizes, you know, swinging a fly for a steelhead versus muskies. I mean, the grabs are so, I mean, you know, steelhead grabs can be different too. I mean, sometimes they're real energetic and pull line, and other times they just, you feel the weight of the fish. But muskie takes really run the gambit in terms of what you might experience. I mean, you may have a fish that kind of just climbs onto that fly, and then next time you strip it, you know, it's kind of there just with weight, you know, and there's other times where you'll actually feel like the tick of a fly, and it just feels like it just kind of something just grabbed at it. But a lot of times that's the fish eating the entire fly and coming at you a little bit. And so in those situations, you don't feel anything, but you know, with experience, you realize that was probably a fish that grabbed your fly, and you need to strip like hell to try to get tight, you know, and be able to set the hook. You know, a lot of other, you know, takes with muskie, and again, another selling point of muskie fishing is a lot of hookups occur right next to the boat, and they're visible, and you see them happen. Muskies have, you know, out of their curiosity, have this ability to, or, you know, have this drive to follow, you know, and whether it's fly fishing or gear fishing, you know, to follow the lure, the fly right back to the boat. And, you know, why they do this, you know, who knows? I mean, you know, are they looking for are they just being curious? Are they looking for, you know, some vulnerability in the prey? You know, I'm sure it's a little of all that. You know, they can follow it because they can, you know, they're on top of the food chain. They don't have to worry about anybody messing with them. So, you know, you get a lot of fish that follow that fly right next to the boat. You know, sometimes they'll grab the fly as it's coming into view. Most of the times to get them to eat at the boat, you need to, you know, change the direction of the fly. You know, so you go into what, you know, we refer to as a figure eight, or, you know, do ovals with the fly. You want to strip that fly down so that's only about 12 to 18 inches away from the tip of the rod so that you can move that fly. Yeah. You know, in a way that, you know, entices the fish to grab. And usually it's, like I said, using, you know, big turns in a figure eight or just big turns in an oval so that fish can follow the fly. And a lot of times they'll grab it as it's going into a turn because, you know, it shows the fish, you know, shows the muskie the fly at a, you know, perpendicular angle, so better attack angle. And, you know, and a lot of times just speeding up the fly, you know, at the boat. you know, entices, you know, makes it look like the fish is, you know, the bait is finally trying to get away from them, you know, and that'll entice them to take. So in those situations, it's, you know, it's a much more visible situation. And again, from a selling point, man, if that doesn't get your, if that doesn't get you going, seeing a, you know, 40, 45 inch fly or fish, 45 inch fish chasing your fly right next to the boat, you know, then you should probably give up fishing in general at that point.
Yeah, that's intense. That's intense. And out of that, how many times when you're doing that, you know, what percentage of those fish are actually taking the fly when you, you know, if you said overall in general in a year?
Boy, you know, I think it, you know, depends on, you know, where you're fishing and whatnot. But I feel like, I don't know if I can get, you know, I'll just say 1/3 of those fish to eat. You know, I think that's probably doing pretty good. I mean, there's days, you know, there's strings where you might get, you know, half of those fish to eat, and there's strings where you know, where it's less. But yeah, I think if you can get one out every three to eat the fly, you're doing pretty well.
And now let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. In today's world of mass-produced products, Stonefly Nets has reclaimed the tradition of handcrafted care with their custom wood landing nets. Stonefly starts the design process by selecting wood for the handle based on a number of key factors, including grain, pattern, and depth, but they don't stop there. This piece of art is accentuated by strips of hardwood that complement and accentuate the handcrafted handle. To be honest, I have never been a huge net guy, mainly because I didn't feel like my old collapsible net was easiest to use and was not easy on the eye, if you know what I mean. The Stonefly net not only looks beautiful, but has high-quality netting that is easy on the fish and will last for years to come. Stonefly's goal is to create a unique custom classic wood net that's second to none and can be customized for a little extra touch. For Ethan, the founder of Stonefly Nets, fly fishing has always had a traditional feel going back to fishing the three-weight bamboo rod with his great-grandmother. When Ethan designs a custom net, it's his hope that others will create amazing lasting memories for years to come. Please head over to wetflyswing.com/stonefly to get your custom net now. That's wetflyswing.com/stonefly, STONEFLY, to get started right now. Okay, now back to the show.
Let's go back. I want to keep on this, just back to your advanced book, and techniques was, I think, chapter 3. You know, you got into dead drifting and swinging, and I was actually just out testing out some strike indicators. I think these were the New Zealand strike indicators. It was like a yarn thing, just, and mm-hmm. they were actually really sweet. I never used yarn indicators when I've done a lot of indicator fishing mm-hmm. for steelhead too, but the yarn is cool. So I guess we won't dig into that today. But as far as the talk about swinging, if we stick on that, what's a, you know, if you think beginner tips versus advanced tips, what is a beginner? If somebody's wondering about swinging flies, what do you tell a beginner? And then what do you tell somebody that's more advanced?
You know, beginners, I would say to, you know, have some understanding of the water that you're fishing. And, you know, and where you would expect to, you know, find steelhead positioned in that water that you're fishing. What I would also say, though, is, you know, and again, I can see this by watching other anglers, understand what, you know, and this could go for beginners or, you know, even more advanced, but understand what your fly is doing. You know, kind of be the fly, you know, really make sure that you're making a cast that straightens out, you know, that's fishing right away. You know, if you got big curves or you're piling up your tip or your leader, you know, that fly isn't fishing right away. So, you know, I always say, you know, make the cast, repeatable cast that you're comfortable with. So again, if you're a beginner caster and, you know, you can continually make 40, 50 foot casts, and make those 80, 90% of the time. And this goes for muskie fishing too. Make that cast and don't try to keep pushing it longer and have a 50% effective cast. So make sure you get that fly. So that's number one, get that fly so that it's turning over well, straight, and fishing right away. But from there, just understand how that fly is presenting itself in the water and making sure that from what you can see that you feel that fly is swimming either, you know, perpendicular to the current or swinging across the current and showing itself in a way that a fish would want to eat it. You know, I think too often I just see anglers just flopping it out there and thinking, well, I'm swinging, you know, it's out there, and without really recognizing that, well, maybe their, you know, their fly's actually going downstream for a while, or it's whipping through there too fast. So just, I think that's the thing that I would say, you know, understand the water and then understand what your fly is doing for beginners. For more advanced anglers, it's just kind of an extension of that, but understand really what you're trying to do with the fly, you know, and make sure that it's, you know, the speed and the depth is where you want it to be for the situation that you're trying to, you know, address. And I guess what I mean by that is, you know, when the water temperatures are in the 50s or 40s, you know, the fish are tend to be a little more aggressive. You can get away with a fly that's maybe swinging a little bit faster. But one thing about steelhead, at least in my estimation, is they want to chase the fly. You know, it's an instinctive reaction to chasing. I'm sure it's either left over from when they were, you know, when they were in the stream or river, same thing out in the lake when they're chasing bait. So it's an instinctive response. But if the fly's traveling too fast, it seems like for a steelhead anyways, that it might be too much effort to chase it type of thing. So I like to have a swinging fly, but controlling the speed enough so that it is accessible to the fish. That's kind of how I think in terms of it, you know, just kind of slowly getting away from them. So too fast of a swing, a lot of times I think is not good. So, you know, controlling that speed by making sure you don't have too big of a downstream belly, you know, I think will go a long way towards, you know, interesting more fish. But at the same time, when the water temperatures are cold, I really want to slow that swing down, you know, and, you know, eliminating the downstream belly, maybe even, pointing the rod tip more across river so you're not getting as much of a belly, so showing the fly a little more, you know, the butt of the fly to the fish as it's kind of working across in more of a slow manner. But the same thing with depth, you know, understanding your depth, either with, you know, controlling your sink tip, controlling the angle of the fly, controlling the, you know, the weight on the fly. Again, when the water's colder or when it's off color, I do want to fish that fly down in the water column, but I don't want it so deep that it's just scraping the bottom the entire time. You know, I do feel like I want it in that bottom zone, that bottom one third of the pool, but making sure that you're not fishing too deep and not scraping the bottom. So understanding both speed and depth control, I think are, you know, the keys for more advanced fishing.
Knowing what the fly is doing, you know, is definitely a good, I mean, how do you know, you know, if you're thinking about it, how are you thinking about that? How do you know what the fly is doing if it's below the surface and you can't really see it?
You know, some of it is, I can tell depth, you know, by if I feel the bottom. So that, I mean, that's the one thing. And again, I don't want to feel a lot about them. I don't really don't want to feel it much at all. Maybe just a tick at the beginning and in letting it swing. I prefer to try to just get the sense that I have the right depth without ever hitting the bottom. Cause I just want it riding a little bit higher up. I just feel as though if it's hitting the bottom, it might even be too low. You know, and I think that almost works against you. So, but that's one area where you can, you know, kind of test it a little bit. Like, am I getting down deep enough? Maybe I'll angle up just a little bit higher, or I'll make a little more of a mend. If I feel one little tick, then I know, okay, well, I must be there, so I can just angle down a little bit more. And, you know, so that's one way to test it. But in terms of, I think there's just a certain amount of experience that's required to really get an understanding of what your fly is doing. But I think the key is just kind of watching where your line, if your line is pointed in a certain direction, you know, you got a tight tip and a tight leader, by extension, you can kind of, you know, get an idea of where your fly is and what it's doing, you know, what angle it's at, you know, and how fast it's moving. But I do think it's, you know, it's a thing by just being observant of your line and your tip for what you can see. And just kind of extrapolating that into the water. But that's really the big key. And I just, like I said, I think that's, if there's one thing that I think differentiates a successful person, a successful angler at swinging a fly from one that isn't, is really just making sure that you understand what your fly is doing at all times.
That's a killer tip. And yeah, especially like you said, for a beginner, that's, you know, if you get out there and you first just kind of swing and trying to get your cast right and stuff like that. And then, yeah, and trying to think about what the fly is doing is almost secondary, but that is a great point. You, in staying on the track, in your advanced book, I think chapter 4 talked about strategy, behavior, and water. And you talked a little bit about there, just water and the fly. What's the behavior? Can you talk a little bit about that? Are you talking digging into a little bit on fish behavior? What would be let's go back to that same thing, kind of a beginner tip and a advanced tip for on the behavior category.
Yeah, I just think that's everything that, you know, understanding how the various conditions impact the fish, from water flow to water temperature to water clarity. Each of those has a tendency. I mean, there's obviously in all fishing, hunting, there's no hard and fast rules, but there's tendencies. And, understanding water flow, there are a lot of spate nature rivers in the Great Lakes. And when you get rain or runoff and it brings up the flow, it usually stirs the pot, usually a good thing for steelhead fishing. And, just like it is out west as well. But, on some larger rivers, it might not be as pronounced as it is on smaller rivers in the Great Lakes. So understanding, that represents an opportunity, and I think more and more anglers, as they become savvy, clearly understand that. I can certainly see that that's no secret any longer, just judging by the number of anglers on some of our rivers, as they're starting to clear up, people understand that. But it is still a key component of this, water flow brings fish in. Understanding water temperature might even be more important, particularly the swings in water temperature. Again, as we go to some of our spate rivers, it's not uncommon if you get a cold snap or a cold night for water temperatures to drop 10, 12 degrees. I've seen dramatic drops. I've seen them, I think, as large as 16 degrees overnight. That has a huge impact on fish's attitude and fish's activity. And so understanding how, if you're swinging flies one day and then you go back after such a cold front has come through the next day, those fish, they're going to have a totally different attitude. You might find them in different water. They might be located more in softer, quiet water. They're not going to chase as much. So really understanding how you might, make adjustments to your swing. A lot of times in those situations too, if I'm fishing on my own, I won't go out first thing in the morning. I'll wait till the afternoon until, water temperatures have at least recovered a bit anyways. Kind of put that, to your advantage that way. And then water clarity, how that impacts, I guess from that standpoint, I think in terms of the clarity being something that impacts my fly selection. I use larger, darker flies in dirtier water. Using smaller, more natural colors, olives and browns and things like that, when the water drops and starts to clear. So just thinking about how those different conditions impact a fish and then how that should in turn impact how you approach the fishing.
What's the, if you go to a clear, super clear condition, super spooky, just super clear, how small flies do you go down? What do you use? And what are you typically using for your flies? What's your style? So you're still using two flies, just small tube flies?
I think when I go to, when you get into those smaller flies, sometimes I'll be tying on those on hooks. So sometimes I just, to try to just keep them more subtle looking and, allow them to sink a little bit more. I'll start going away from the tubes on the real small patterns. I just like little buggy patterns. I mean, even, you know, honestly, just some small woolly buggers and things like that, you know, I think are good. Small woolly buggers, small wet flies, you know, are a good match for when that water gets really low and clear. And that's the one time where, you know, I feel for the most part, I'm not too worried about leader and tippet size, when I'm swinging flies. You know, I my feeling is I always want to have a heavy enough tippet to withstand, you know, the grab and turn of any big fish. I mean, I think it's, you know, a mistake to break off any fish when you're swinging. I just don't think there's, you know, there's any the need to go any lower than you need to, because the fish is reacting to the fly and seeing it from the side or behind. But I do say when the water gets low and clear, you know, there is an element of stealth, especially if you continue to swing in those conditions, that can go a long way. And, you know, a lot of times I'll go to, you know, one of my more effective approaches for low clear water is to go to like a Scandi line or other, you know, other, and just a long, monofilament and then to a, fluorocarbon tip leader, and then just a weighted fly, you know, some type of a weighted, you know, bugger or, you know, bunny bugger or something along that line. But even a weighted woolly bugger, is a really good approach for when, you know, things get really low and clear, and it just adds an element of stealth. Yeah.
That's cool. And on those leaders, when you're low and clear, is that just a typical, you're just using a pretty long leader, or what do you got going there?
Yeah, it's usually about the length of the rod. So it's, you know, and that allows you to, you know, cast pretty easily with a Scandi line.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. Well, this is good. And we're touching on the fly. I guess just on that fly, as you mentioned flies, that was, I think, chapter 5 in the advanced book. What's, you know, do you have a go-to wet fly that you're putting on either in, out there in the Cattaraugus or if you're out west?
Yeah, my go-to is pretty much the same, you know, in BC as it is in the Great Lakes. And just, I just like a Marabou tube. I mean, real simple, you know, usually two colors, you know, black over purple, black over blue are two of my favorite color combinations. I tie that in a reverse tie manner so that, you know, it stays puffed up, gives it some silhouette in the water and a lot of movement, usually add some flash to it as well. Just to try to, you know, put that element in there. I think it does attract fish, you know, when that fly's swinging and it hits different light, you know, I think that adds a realistic element to it. But to me, that's my go-to fly. It's just that, just very simple. It's simple to tie. You know, I seem like I get really good hookups with the tube and having that, hook right at the very rear of the materials. I also like some bunny flies. You know, there's one that I've always used called a bunny spay that, I kind of came up with a number of years back. I used to tie it on a hook. I tie those on tubes now as well. And, and those are wide variety of colors, black, purple, white, you know, olive. So those are my go-tos, but, you know, and then I have some other more traditional looking wet flies that I'll use at times as well, but it's, you know, it's kind of hard to beat, you know, those flies that have been working for so many years.
Exactly. Well, and as we kind of wrap this thing up here, Rick, we got, I guess the final chapter 6 in that advanced book, you talked about just different rivers and streams. And we mentioned the Cattaraugus at the start. If we stay on that, assuming you cover that, what streams do you cover for in the book? Do you cover like one stream for each state, or do you cover a bunch of different streams?
It covers a various rivers and streams on each state. And I think it focuses on some of the more prominent and popular fisheries. I shouldn't even say popular, but more prominent fisheries. Has an element in there of really more the where to is a lot about the character and characteristics of that river, you know, versus, you know, where to start and things of that nature. You know, there's an emphasis in there on identifying the rivers that have natural reproduction, you know, and those rivers that kind of create a, or, you know, provide for a quality experience, either whether because of their size or because of, you know, the scenery involved, or again, wild fish, or, you know, level the run and things of that nature. So try to incorporate, you know, all of those types of factors in there. And, you know, I feel as though if you can have that kind of starting information, it's easy enough to Google where to actually get started on a river anymore. So, you know, I think more of the characteristics, you know, of that river is probably more important in terms of somebody finding the type of experience they're looking for.
I guess before we leave this, I'm just thinking characteristics. If you're going to a river you're not totally familiar with and you're trying to, you know, again, read water, find fish, you know, what is there a kind of a, beginner or advanced tip on that for somebody? How do they, you know, starting off new, how do you find those fish if you don't know where they're at and you can't see anything?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, you know, just trying to, you know, read water on the, from the surface anyways. I mean, you know, going to a new spot, generally, you know, I always have a inclination to walk away from the main access points. So to me, the first thing to do is to never fish at the pool right near the parking lot, you know, unless maybe there's absolutely nobody in it. But, you know, so that's always my first thing is, you know, think in terms of, okay, here's the access point. I'm going to at least walk this far down type of thing. But I, you know, I'm just trying to visualize, you know, the type of water that has, you know, a depth of 2 to 3 feet, at least, you know, at a minimum, and has, you know, a current that's probably in that 2 to 3, you know, miles per hour, you know, the same, same pace as my walking pace. I think that's always a, you know, good starting point, trying to recognize some water that has, you know, at least some element of structure. So trying to identify some, you know, some elements on the surface that would look like there's boulders or drop-offs or ledges or something along that line, you know, and that's always a good starting point for me.
Yeah. Perfect. Well, I guess, you know, we're going to take this out of here and, you know, we've talked a little bit out. I don't think we're going to go into the 222 here other than I'm just curious on resources as you write, you know, another book on it. This is going to be another cool resource. But what else is out there for folks? I always love to hear that, you know, maybe somebody, you know, that's not the stuff you've written. Where do you direct them if they're coming to the Great Lakes? Maybe they want to get some, you know, some advanced techniques or beginner. Is there some other good stuff out there?
Well, I think in terms of two-handed fishing, you know, I learned quite a bit from Simon Gosver's spey casting book. I mean, I still think that's still a really good source, you know, in terms of, you know, I talked about, you know, in my book that, you know, has step-by-step in pictures, he has step-by-step photos and a lot more in depth. So I do think that's a really good resource. I know that's something that I learned a lot from. So I think that's a good resource. There are, like I said, a handful of other, you know, shops in the Great Lakes that are, you know, promoting swinging flies and spey casting and, you know, a number of good instructors. I mean, if you go to pretty much any of the major river systems in the Great Lakes, there's guides and instructors now that are, you know, top notch, you know, so that's come a long way in the last, you know, 10, 15 years in the Great Lakes. So there's, you know, a lot of great guys that, great guys and women that are, you know, willing to, you know, to share their knowledge and their passion.
Nice. And, the Salmon River, so that's one up there. Is that the busiest river in the country? You always hear these stories about how shoulder to shoulder and all that stuff. Are there any others that are busy like that?
It's certainly, if it isn't the busiest, it's certainly got to be in the top five. But you know, that being said, it's still a beautiful place. And, you know, the worst pressure occurs when the Chinook salmon are in. And, you know, you get to this time of year when it's, you know, it's a pretty hardy environment up there in terms of weather and cold. And you get to this time of year and you really can find a quality experience up on that river. And those fish, even in, you know, water temperatures that are in the 30s, when there's fresh fish coming in, they can be pretty aggressive and they'll still charge a swung fly pretty well. So there's, you know, in my mind, there's ways to get around the pressure on every river. You know, you just have to think about them. Sometimes it's, you know, taking advantage of shoulder periods, inclement weather, you know, hiking, you know, floating, things of that nature. But, you know, no matter how busy, I mean, all our rivers are getting busy. It's really, if I had to, you know, point to one thing, the biggest difference in the last 20 years, it's, you know, how much more crowded the rivers are nowadays. You know, the available information has made it so that anglers are much more efficient now, in terms of being on the water on the good days. But, you know, I still believe that there's ways to beat that as well. And the Salmon River is, you know, one of those, a really good spey fishing river for sure.
That's cool. All right, Rick, well, I'll let you get out of here. I guess the next year, I guess your book, is that the biggest thing coming up for you? Or anything else you want to give a
yes,
shout out?
Yes, yeah.
When's that going to be published? Do you have any idea?
I'm going to say probably about a year from now.
Okay.
I think that's about the process usually takes. So, but I'm not sure. But I would say with about a year from now, I would expect to see it. Yeah. If I can get it all finished up.
Perfect. So between now and the end of the book, is it pretty much just working on getting the book ready, or do you have any other big things going on out there?
You know, the one thing that I really want to start doing in the next, you know, next year is more video type of presentations, and, you know, really just doing more YouTube type stuff, and really working in that area. So what I'd really like to do is, and again, the idea of doing it and getting it all done is, but, you know, kind of take my last couple of books and break down some of those items in there, and, you know, just do short little video clips on them, and, you know, take a section and just try to do it more in a, you know, video format. So that's one thing I'm going to try to work on over the next year or two.
That's a great idea. Yeah. I think that'll be awesome. Yeah. YouTube is just going to keep growing. And yeah, I mean, the more you talk about it, I was thinking, Cheech from Fly Fish Food was on, and he made the note. I was asking him about writing books. So it's interesting, cause you're writing the book here, but I asked him if he's going to be writing any books anytime soon. He's like, no, he's like, I don't think so, because the YouTube videos they do can just connect with so many more people. You know, the fact that instantly it would take him, you know, a year or whatever to do the book, but he can publish, you know, how many videos in the year, and it'll connect with thousands of people. So I think it's smart to get into the YouTube. The challenge is obviously YouTube is not easy to do well. That's the struggle. But, yeah, man, if you do it well, I'm looking forward to that. I'll definitely be watching some of those videos for sure, because the book is, some people are, you know, some people are audio, some people are video, some people love reading. And if you can present it to everybody, that's a good thing. Cool. Well,
that's kind of my feeling. And like you said, you hit it right on. You got to do it well. I mean, you know, you can go out and do it, and if it looks like you know, yeah, you're producing it.
Yeah, I know.
You know, it just has to look good. It has to represent, you know, a certain level of quality, and that's where I need to work on right now.
Yeah, that's it. Awesome. All right, Rick. Well, we'll send everybody to, I guess, just rickkustage.com, right?
Yeah, that sounds good, Dave. Yep, I can. You can send me messages there. You can kind of see what else I'm up to, and you know, go from there.
Okay. Cool. Well, thanks for taking the time today. This has been awesome to dig into it. I think it's always, you know, you always think, you know, how do you do another Steelhead episode? But I feel like I could probably do all Steelhead episodes. But do you feel like we got some, I mean, I guess we touched on a lot. Do you feel like we missed a few things? Where would you send people if we didn't touch on everything today to your stuff? Do you think just grab that advanced book, or is anything else?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that goes into all the in depth. I mean, I feel like there's everything you need in the advanced book to take advantage of the Great Lakes fishery, for sure.
Okay.
And yes, specific questions, people can reach out to me.
Perfect. All right. We'll catch up with you soon, and we'll go from there.
Okay. Great, Dave. It was great talking with you, and we'll be in touch.
So there you go. If you want to find all the show notes, all the links and everything else we covered today, head over to wetflyswing.com/277. That's 277. Reminder, if you want to ask a question for an upcoming guest, you can head over to wetflyswing.com/Facebook and just leave a quick note right there, and you can ask a question. That's all I have for you today. I want to thank you for stopping by to hang out, and hope you enjoyed the show, and hope you connect with me online or on the river.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.